A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Here's a question that has been quietly haunting psychiatry for decades. The most effective drugs we have for ADHD, the stimulants, work remarkably well for focus and impulse control, but they also raise your heart rate and blood pressure. For millions of patients, that means choosing between a functional brain and a strained cardiovascular system. Daniel sent us this one, and he's asking whether that trade-off is baked into the mechanism itself. Could we design a drug that targets dopamine with the precision of a stimulant, but leaves the heart alone? And what about the agitation and anxiety that come with the territory? Is there a path to a cleaner molecule, or is the side effect the price of the ticket?
This is the kind of question that sounds simple until you crack open the pharmacology, because the answer is both yes and no, and the no is really stubborn.
That's what I was afraid of.
Here's why this matters right now. ADHD diagnosis rates keep climbing, not because of some TikTok trend, but because we're catching cases missed for decades, especially in adults and women. At the same time, we've got better data on the cardiovascular risks. A 2023 meta-analysis in Neuroscience and Biobehavioral Reviews found that even low-dose stimulants bump heart rate by 5 to 10 beats per minute and systolic blood pressure by 3 to 5 millimeters of mercury. For someone with borderline hypertension or an undiagnosed arrhythmia, that's a real clinical problem.
The patient population is expanding into demographics where cardiac risk is already a concern. Adults in their 40s and 50s getting diagnosed for the first time, who might already be on blood pressure medication.
The current clinical workaround is messy. You've got patients on a stimulant plus a beta blocker, or a stimulant plus guanfacine, and now you're managing polypharmacy for what started as a focus problem. The question Daniel's asking, whether we can decouple the efficacy from the cardiac effects. That's the bottleneck for treating a huge and growing patient population.
Let's frame this as a detective story. We've got a crime scene, the synapse. We've got a suspect, dopamine. And we've got collateral damage, the heart. The question is whether the suspect and the damage are inseparable, or whether our investigative tools are just too blunt to tell the difference.
Like any good detective story, the first thing we need to do is look at the mechanism, not the hand-wavy dopamine goes up version, the actual molecular choreography.
Which is where you get to do your favorite thing.
I contain multitudes of favorite things. But before we dive into the synaptic weeds, let's establish the two families of drugs we're talking about, because the distinction matters for the whole story. On one side, you've got the stimulants, methylphenidate, which is Ritalin and Concerta, and the amphetamine-based drugs like Adderall and Vyvanse. Analyses consistently show effect sizes of 0.8 to 1.0 for ADHD symptom reduction, which in psychiatry is enormous. Most psychiatric drugs are thrilled to hit 0.5.
On the other side?
The non-stimulants. Atomoxetine, which is Stratera, a selective norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor, and guanfacine and conidine, which are alpha-2, adrenergic agonists. Their effect sizes cluster around 0.4 to 0.6. Noticeable, clinically meaningful, but not in the same league.
You've got a clear efficacy gap. The stimulants work better, but they come with the cardiac baggage. The non-stimulants are gentler on the heart, or at least that's the reputation, but they don't deliver the same cognitive punch.
That reputation is only half true. Atomoxetine still raises heart rate and blood pressure in a lot of patients. It's not a cardiac-free pass. Guanfacine and clonidine actually lower blood pressure, but they do it by dampening sympathetic outflow from the brainstem, which also makes people tired and dizzy. So you're trading one set of problems for another.
Daniel's question has a sharper edge than it first appears. It's not just, can we make stimulants safer for the heart? It's, is there a molecular loophole that lets us get stimulant-level efficacy through a mechanism that doesn't touch the cardiovascular system at all?
To answer that, we need to understand what's actually happening at the synapse when a stimulant molecule shows up. Here's the key misconception that even a lot of clinicians carry around. They think stimulants raise heart rate because of dopamine. Dopamine equals arousal equals faster heartbeat, right?
That's what I would have assumed.
It's wrong. The cardiac effects are driven by norepinephrine, and the reason that distinction matters is that it suggests a possible separation. If the heart effects come from norepinephrine spillover and the cognitive benefits come from dopamine modulation, then theoretically you could have one without the other. When a stimulant enters the brain, it blocks the reuptake transporters that normally vacuum neurotransmitters back out of the synapse. Methylphenidate blocks DAT, the dopamine transporter, and NET, the norepinephrine transporter. Amphetamine does the same thing but also reverses the direction of those transporters, pushing dopamine and norepinephrine out into the synapse. Either way, you end up with more of both neurotransmitters hanging around.
The dopamine does the focus thing.
Dopamine in the prefrontal cortex and striatum improves attention, working memory, and impulse control. That's the target. But the norepinephrine, some of it is doing useful things in the prefrontal cortex too, spills over into the peripheral system. Once norepinephrine hits beta-1 receptors in the heart, heart rate goes up. Once it hits alpha-1 receptors in the blood vessels, they constrict and blood pressure rises. That's the collateral damage.
If the problem is norepinephrine spillover, why can't we just build a molecule that only blocks DAT and leaves NET alone?
This is where the molecular biology gets stubborn. DAT and NET are 67% homologous in their transmembrane binding domains, the part of the protein where drugs actually dock. They're shaped almost identically. Designing a small molecule that slots into one but not the other is like designing a key that opens your front door but not your back door when both locks were made by the same manufacturer.
Herman, it gets worse. In the prefrontal cortex, ground zero for ADHD symptoms, dopamine is primarily cleared not by DAT but by NET. The norepinephrine transporter is doing double duty. So if you built a perfectly selective DAT inhibitor that left NET completely untouched, you'd get great dopamine elevation in the striatum, but much less in the prefrontal cortex. You'd be leaving the most important brain region for attention on the table. The very thing that makes NET a problem, its role in the cardiac effects, is also what makes it essential for dopamine clearance in the part of the brain we most want to treat.
That's the trap. The overlap isn't a bug in our current drugs, it's a feature of the underlying biology, and that's why Daniel's question is so sharp. It's not just, can we be more selective? It's, is selectivity even the right strategy given how the system is wired?
Walk me through the agitation and anxiety piece. Because for a lot of patients, that's as big a deal as the heart rate. You take your medication, your focus improves, and suddenly you feel like you've had 6 espressos and someone's watching you.
The mechanism there is different from the cardiac effects. Excessive dopaminergic tone in the mesolimbic pathway, the nucleus accumbens, and the amygdala can trigger anxiety and agitation. Some of it is also norepinephrine hitting the locus coeruleus and ramping up the fight-or-flight system. But the dopamine component is real, and it's modulated by genetics. COMT and DRD2 polymorphisms change how fast you clear dopamine and how sensitive your D2 receptors are. 2 people on the same dose can have completely different anxiety profiles.
Even if we solve the cardiac problem by somehow siloing norepinephrine, we'd still have the anxiety problem from dopamine itself in some patients.
Though that one is arguably more manageable because it's more dose-dependent and more genetically predictable. But it means the ideal drug Daniel's imagining, stimulant efficacy with 0 side effects, would need to solve 2 separate problems at once. Cardiac sparing and limbic sparing. 2 different mechanisms, 2 different brain circuits.
Right now, our best drugs hit everything. Dopamine, norepinephrine, the circuits you want, the circuits you don't. It's a pharmacological sledgehammer.
A sledgehammer that happens to be remarkably effective at its target, which is why we keep using it. But the question is whether we can build a scalpel that's just as effective. And that's where the research frontier gets interesting, because there are approaches in the pipeline that try to sidestep the transporter problem entirely.
Before we get to the pipeline, I want to sit with that 67% homology. Is that number as discouraging as it sounds, or are there structural differences a clever medicinal chemist could exploit?
It's discouraging, but not hopeless. The binding pockets aren't identical. There are subtle differences in the extracellular loops and in the way the transmembrane helices are arranged. The problem is that the differences are subtle enough that no one has successfully exploited them yet. Every compound that's been tried either hits both transporters or hits neither. Modafinil was supposed to be the exception, a weak DAT inhibitor that was cardiac neutral. Early trials looked promising, but post-market data showed it still increased heart rate in sensitive individuals. Even a weak hit on the system was enough.
The homology problem has real clinical teeth. It's not an abstract biochemistry footnote.
It's the reason we're still having this conversation in 2026 instead of having solved it in 2010. And understanding why this is hard makes you appreciate the cleverness of the approaches that are actually showing promise.
I want to name something lurking under this whole conversation. There's a tension in psychopharmacology between efficacy and specificity. The most effective psychiatric drugs tend to be the messiest ones, the ones that hit multiple targets. SSRIs hit multiple serotonin receptors. Atypical antipsychotics hit dopamine and serotonin and histamine. The stimulants hit dopamine and norepinephrine. Every time we try to get more specific, we seem to lose efficacy.
That's a profound observation, and it's not coincidence. The brain doesn't organize its problems by neurotransmitter. ADHD involves multiple circuits, multiple receptor types, multiple brain regions. Hitting one target with surgical precision might be less effective than a broader modulation that nudges the whole system. The trick is finding the minimum effective promiscuity, enough targets to work, but not so many that you cause unacceptable side effects.
The Goldilocks polypharmacology.
That's the frame for the pipeline discussion. The question isn't just, can we make a pure dopamine drug? It's, can we hit the right combination of targets to get efficacy without the cardiac and anxiety baggage? That's a harder question, but it's the right one.
Let's look at exactly what these molecules are doing at the synapse, because the answer to Daniel's question lives in the molecular details.
Let's lay out the cast of characters properly. On the stimulant side, you've got methylphenidate, Ritalin, Concerta, and the amphetamine-based drugs, Adderall, Vyvanse, Dexedrine. Different molecular structures, slightly different mechanisms, but they share a core trick. They flood the synapse with dopamine and norepinephrine by messing with the transporters that normally clean those neurotransmitters up.
The non-stimulants?
Three main players. Atomoxetine, brand name Stratera, a selective norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. Then guanfacine and clonidine, alpha-2, a adrenergic agonists, completely different mechanism. They don't touch transporters at all. They activate receptors in the prefrontal cortex that strengthen signaling in attention networks.
The non-stimulants aren't even a single category pharmacologically. They're just everything that isn't a stimulant.
Right, and that's important because they have completely different side effect profiles. But here's the number that defines the clinical dilemma. When you pool the analytic data, stimulants show effect sizes of 0.8 to 1.0. In psychiatry, anything above 0.8 is considered a large effect. Most antidepressants live in the 0.3 range. Stimulants are in a different universe. The non-stimulants cluster around 0.4 to 0.6. Clinically meaningful, but not the same magnitude. If you have a patient with severe ADHD struggling to hold down a job or stay in school, that gap matters enormously.
The trade-off is brutally simple. Take the drug that works best, and accept that it's going to push your heart rate and blood pressure into potentially dangerous territory. Or take the gentler drug, and accept that your symptoms might not be fully controlled.
It's not just a theoretical risk. That analysis, 5 to 10 beats per minute, 3 to 5 millimeters of mercury, those are averages. Some patients see much larger increases. If you're a 45-year-old with undiagnosed ADHD and early hypertension, a 10-beat increase in resting heart rate sustained over years is a real cardiovascular burden.
Which raises the question that's probably occurred to every listener by now. If we've known about this trade-off for decades, why haven't we solved it?
Because the non-stimulants are solving a different problem than the stimulants. Atomoxetine raises norepinephrine levels, which helps attention. Norepinephrine in the prefrontal cortex improves signal-to-noise ratio, but it doesn't directly boost dopamine in the striatum, where a lot of the impulse control and motivation effects come from. It's doing half the job. Guanfacine and clonidine are even more indirect. They strengthen prefrontal cortical networks by acting on postsynaptic alpha-2A receptors, which improves working memory and reduces distractibility. But they don't increase dopamine or norepinephrine at all. In fact, they reduce norepinephrine release from the locus coeruleus. That's why they lower blood pressure instead of raising it.
Which sounds great for the heart, but apparently not so great for the full ADHD symptom picture.
The sedation and dizziness that come with guanfacine and clonidine are not just annoying side effects. They're the same mechanism that lowers blood pressure. You're turning down the sympathetic dial, and that affects alertness and energy as much as it affects vascular tone. You can't decouple them because they're the same physiological lever.
The core question, is there a way to get stimulant-level efficacy without the cardiac effects, is really about whether dopamine and norepinephrine can be pried apart in the brain.
That's where we need to go next. The misconception most people carry around is that stimulants raise heart rate because of dopamine. It's intuitive, but it's wrong. The cardiac effects are driven almost entirely by norepinephrine spillover. When you block NET, norepinephrine builds up not just in the brain, but in the peripheral nervous system. Peripheral norepinephrine is a potent activator of beta-1 receptors in the heart and alpha-1 receptors in blood vessels. Dopamine itself has very little direct effect on the cardiovascular system at therapeutic doses.
Which sounds like good news. If the problem is norepinephrine and the benefit is dopamine, just build a drug that only hits dopamine.
That's exactly where the molecular biology gets stubborn. I mentioned the 67% homology between DAT and NET. Both are members of the SLC6 family of sodium-dependent neurotransmitter transporters. 12 transmembrane helices, very similar folding patterns, and the binding pockets where drugs dock are nearly identical. But it's worse than that. In most of the brain, dopamine is cleared from the synapse by DAT. But in the prefrontal cortex, the region most directly implicated in ADHD's core deficits, dopamine is primarily cleared not by DAT, but by NET. The norepinephrine transporter is moonlighting as a dopamine cleanup crew.
So, in the exact brain region we most need to boost dopamine, the transporter that clears dopamine is the one we're trying not to block.
That's the trap. A perfectly selective DAT inhibitor, if you could even build one, would raise dopamine nicely in the striatum, which helps with motivation and impulse control. But it would do much less in the prefrontal cortex because NET is still vacuuming dopamine out of there. You'd get a partial response. Meanwhile, NET is also clearing norepinephrine everywhere, including the periphery, so you haven't touched the cardiac problem.
The overlap isn't just a drug design inconvenience. It's the reason the current drugs work as well as they do. They're messy, but the messiness is hitting the right combination of targets.
Methylphenidate blocks both DAT and NNET. That gives you dopamine elevation in the striatum via DOT blockade, plus dopamine elevation in the prefrontal cortex via NET blockade, plus norepinephrine elevation that improves attention by improving signal-to-noise ratio in cortical circuits. The norepinephrine in the prefrontal cortex isn't just a side effect, it's contributing to efficacy. The trade-off is that same norepinephrine boost is also hitting the heart through beta-1 adrenergic receptors in the sinoatrial node and alpha-1 receptors on vascular smooth muscle.
Amphetamine does the same thing but through a slightly different door.
Methylphenidate is primarily a reuptake inhibitor. Amphetamine does that too, but it also enters the presynaptic neuron and reverses the direction of DAT and VMAT2, the vesicular monoamine transporter. Dopamine gets dumped out of vesicles into the cytoplasm, and then DAT, now running in reverse, pumps it out into the synapse. Amphetamine is not just blocking the cleanup crew, it's actively flooding the room. Both drug classes converge on the same problem, elevated norepinephrine in the periphery driving cardiovascular effects.
What about the anxiety piece? That feels like a different mechanism entirely.
The agitation and anxiety some patients experience is primarily a central nervous system phenomenon. Excessive dopaminergic tone in the mesolimbic pathway, the circuit running through the nucleus accumbens and the amygdala, can directly trigger anxiety. Some of it is also norepinephrine activating the locus coeruleus, a key node in the stress response. So you've got two separate circuits causing two separate problems. Cardiac from peripheral norepinephrine, anxiety from central dopamine and norepinephrine overactivation.
The individual variability is enormous, which tells you genetics is playing a major role.
COMT is the enzyme that breaks down dopamine in the prefrontal cortex. Depending on whether you have the VAU or MET allele, you clear dopamine faster or slower. If you're a slow metabolizer and you take a stimulant, you might get a much bigger dopamine buildup than someone with the fast variant. Same dose, completely different experience. Polymorphisms in DRD2 affect receptor density and sensitivity. the genetics of stimulant response is its own subfield, and we're still in early days of translating it into clinical practice.
The same dose of the same drug hits two different people in completely different ways, because their dopamine and norepinephrine systems are tuned differently at the genetic level.
Which is why any next-generation drug that claims to solve the side effect problem has to contend with this variability. A drug that's cardiac neutral on average might still cause anxiety in someone with a particular COMT variant. The target is moving.
The core insight still holds. The cardiac effects are not from dopamine, they're from norepinephrine spillover, which means, at least in principle, there's a separation to be exploited.
In principle, yes. The question is whether the separation can be achieved at the molecular level given how intertwined these systems are. And that's what makes the current pipeline so interesting, because they're not trying to build a better DAT inhibitor. They're trying to modulate dopamine through completely different mechanisms that bypass the transporter problem entirely. Now that we understand the mechanism, the obvious question is, if the cardiac effects come from norepinephrine, why don't the non-stimulants, which target norepinephrine, work as well? Let's look at what they're doing differently.
Atomoxetine is a selective NET inhibitor. By the logic we just established, it should also raise heart rate and blood pressure. And it does.
That's the first misconception we need to put to rest. The idea that non-stimulant automatically means cardiac safe. In clinical trials, atomoxetine increased heart rate by an average of 6 to 9 beats per minute and diastolic blood pressure by about 3 to 4 millimeters of mercury. Those numbers are right in the same neighborhood as the stimulants.
A drug that doesn't touch dopamine at all still hits the heart. That pretty definitively proves your point, that norepinephrine is the culprit.
It's the cleanest natural experiment we have. Atomoxetine blocks NET, norepinephrine builds up, heart rate goes up, case closed on the mechanism question. But here's where it gets interesting for Daniel's bigger question about efficacy. Atomoxetine raises norepinephrine everywhere. Prefrontal cortex, sure, but also the periphery. And yet its effect size is only 0.5 to 0.6, compared to 0.8 to 1.0 for stimulants. So it's getting the cardiac downside of norepinephrine elevation without the full cognitive upside.
Which means norepinephrine alone isn't enough. You need the dopamine piece too.
Atomoxetine does increase dopamine in the prefrontal cortex indirectly, because NET clears dopamine there, blocking NET raises both, but it doesn't touch dopamine in the striatum at all. And the striatum is critical for motivation, reward processing, and impulse control. So atomoxetine gives you part of the picture but leaves a gaping hole where the striatal dopamine effects should be.
What about guanfacine and clonidine?
Completely different story. They're alpha-2, A adrenergic agonists. They don't block transporters at all. Instead, they mimic norepinephrine at a specific receptor subtype in the prefrontal cortex, strengthening the neural signals involved in working memory and attention. It's a postsynaptic mechanism. You're not flooding the synapse with more neurotransmitter. You're making the existing circuitry more responsive, and they actually lower blood pressure. That's what they were originally developed for. From a cardiac perspective, they're the opposite of stimulants.
That sounds like exactly what Daniel's asking for. Cardiac safety plus ADHD efficacy. What's the catch?
The catch is that turning down the sympathetic nervous system has consequences for alertness and energy. Guanfacine and clonidine cause significant sedation and dizziness. And the efficacy effect sizes in the 0.4 to 0.6 range is solid but not spectacular. You're calming the system down to improve focus, which works for some aspects of attention, but doesn't give you the motivational drive and impulse control that dopamine in the striatum provides.
Guanfacine is basically saying, we'll improve your focus by quieting the noise, but we won't give you the activation that stimulants provide. It's a different strategy entirely.
That's why, in clinical practice, guanfacine is often used as an adjunct to a stimulant rather than a replacement. You get the dopamine drive from the stimulant and the prefrontal tuning from the guanfacine, and the guanfacine partially offsets the cardiac effects of the stimulant. It's clever polypharmacy, but it's still polypharmacy.
None of the existing non-stimulants escape the trap. Atomoxetine hits the heart without the full benefit. Guanfacine spares the heart, but sedates and underdelivers on efficacy. The stimulants work great, but stress the cardiovascular system. Which brings us back to the molecular loophole question. Could we build a drug that selectively inhibits DAT without touching NET?
This is where the structural biology gets genuinely humbling. The binding pocket of DAT and NET differs by only a handful of amino acid residues. We're talking about a few atoms worth of difference in a protein over 600 amino acids long. Medicinal chemists have been trying to exploit those differences for decades. No one has succeeded. The best selective DAT inhibitors we have are research tools, not drugs. They're too bulky, don't cross the blood-brain barrier well, and even they aren't perfectly selective.
Modafinil was supposed to be the exception.
Modafinil is the cautionary tale. It's a weak DAT inhibitor, initially thought to be cardiac neutral. Early clinical data looked clean. But once it was on the market, post-market surveillance showed heart rate increases in sensitive individuals. Even a weak tap on the transporter system was enough to move the cardiovascular needle. The transporter system is so tightly coupled that even modest pharmacological intervention ripples through to the cardiovascular system. It's not that we haven't been clever enough, it's that the biology is resistant to separation.
Which is why the most interesting approaches in the pipeline right now don't target transporters at all.
If you can't separate DAT from NET pharmacologically, you need a completely different mechanism for modulating dopamine. And that's where tracheamine-associated receptor 1, TAAAR1, comes in.
That's a receptor, not a transporter.
TAAR1 is a G-protein-coupled receptor expressed in dopamine and serotonin neurons. When you activate it, it modulates dopamine release through a completely different pathway than reuptake blockade. It doesn't touch DAT or NET at all. Instead, it reduces the firing rate of dopamine neurons and alters how much dopamine is released per impulse. It's a modulator, not a floodgate.
It's more like a volume knob than an on-off switch.
That's exactly the right image. A stimulant is like jamming the reuptake vacuum in the on position. Dopamine accumulates because cleanup is blocked. A TAAR1 agonist is more like adjusting the thermostat. It changes the set point of the dopamine system without creating a massive buildup.
There's actual clinical data on this?
Ulotaront, also known as SCP-356-856, is a TAAR1 agonist that went through a phase 2 trial in adults with ADHD in 2024. 30% reduction in ADHD rating scale scores compared to 45% for methylphenidate, so it's not quite matching the stimulant yet, but it's in the ballpark. And here's the number that matters for Daniel's question. Heart rate increase was 2 beats per minute for ulotaront versus 8 beats per minute for methylphenidate.
2 versus 8. That's a clinically meaningful separation.
Not zero, but dramatically lower. And because TAAR1 agonists don't block NET at all, you're not getting that peripheral norepinephrine spillover. The cardiac signal is massively attenuated. This is the first real evidence that the separation is possible in humans. The cardiac effects are not baked into dopamine modulation. They're baked into the transporter blocking mechanism we've been using for decades. Change the mechanism, and you change the side effect profile.
What's the catch?
The efficacy gap. 30% symptom reduction versus 45% is real. For some patients, that difference is the gap between functional and struggling. We don't yet know if higher doses close that gap or if TAAR1 agonism has a ceiling effect. Phase 3 trials are expected to read out in 2027 to 2028. Those will give us much better data on both efficacy, durability, and cardiovascular safety over time.
What's the other path? You mentioned D1 receptor partial agonists.
This is a completely different strategy. Instead of modulating dopamine release, you go straight to the postsynaptic receptors. Dopamine D1 receptors in the prefrontal cortex are critical for working memory and attention. A D1 partial agonist would gently activate those receptors, enough to improve cognition, but not so much that you trigger the anxiety and agitation from overstimulating limbic D2 receptors. In theory, you'd get cognitive benefits without any peripheral effects at all, because D1 receptors in the prefrontal cortex have no direct line to the heart. The problem has been execution. DAR0100, a D1 partial agonist, showed promising cognitive effects in early trials, but it had terrible bioavailability. No one's cracked the formulation problem yet.
TAAR1 is ahead in the race, but D1 is still theoretically interesting if someone solves the delivery problem.
There's a third approach worth mentioning, though it's even earlier stage. Some groups are looking at whether you can design a prodrug, a compound that's inactive in the bloodstream but gets activated only once it crosses into the brain. If you could make a DAT inhibitor that only becomes active inside the central nervous system, you'd get the dopamine boost where you want it without the peripheral norepinephrine effects. Prodrugs are real. Vyvanse is one, lisdexamfetamine. But that activation still happens in the periphery. The Holy Grail would be a prodrug activated by an enzyme that only exists in the brain. No one's close to clinical trials on that yet.
Where does that leave us? Here's what actually matters for clinicians and patients right now.
The most actionable clinical insight comes directly from the mechanism we've been discussing. For patients with mild hypertension or well-controlled cardiovascular disease who need stimulant-level efficacy, the best current strategy is probably guanfacine augmentation of a low-dose stimulant. The guanfacine blunts the sympathetic outflow that drives the cardiac effects, while the stimulant, even at a lower dose, provides the dopamine modulation. You're getting the best of both mechanisms without maxing out either one's side effect profile. The clinical data supports this. Guanfacine's blood pressure lowering effect partially offsets the stimulant's pressor effect.
What about the anxiety piece? For a lot of patients, that's the deal breaker.
This is where propranolol comes in, and it's underutilized for this indication. Propranolol is a beta blocker that crosses the blood-brain barrier. It blocks those peripheral beta-1 receptors. Heart rate goes down. The physical sensation of a pounding chest goes away, and here's the interesting part, that somatic feedback loop is a major driver of stimulant-induced anxiety. Your brain senses your heart racing and interprets it as danger. Break that loop, and the anxiety often diminishes significantly, without blunting the cognitive benefits of the stimulant.
You're not treating the anxiety directly with a sedative. You're interrupting the physical signal that the brain is misinterpreting.
That's a much cleaner intervention than adding an SSRI or a benzodiazepine. Propranolol is well understood, generic, cheap, and the side effect profile is manageable for most people. If you're a patient experiencing stimulant-induced anxiety, this is absolutely a conversation to have with your doctor. It's not right for everyone. If you have asthma, beta blockers can be problematic, but it's an option that doesn't get enough attention.
The forward-looking piece. What should people watch for in the pipeline?
The TAAR1 agonist phase 3 trials are the nearest term hope. If those trials confirm the phase 2 signal, meaningful efficacy with minimal cardiovascular effects, that changes the treatment landscape. The second thing to watch is any D1 selective compound that solves the bioavailability problem and enters clinical trials. That's further out, but it's the cleanest mechanistic path to a cardiac neutral cognitive enhancer.
The honest timeline?
5 to 10 years before anything reaches the market, assuming the phase 3 data is strong. That's not pessimism, that's just how drug development works. But the direction of travel is clear. We now have proof of concept that you can modulate dopamine effectively without hitting the cardiovascular system hard. The separation Daniel's asking about is not a fantasy, it's an engineering problem.
Which brings us to the insight. The cardiac effects were never inherent to dopamine modulation. They were inherent to our molecular tools being too blunt. We've been using transporter blockade because it works, not because it's the only way. And now we're finally developing tools with sharper edges.
The analogy I keep coming back to is surgery. For decades, if you needed an appendectomy, you got a big abdominal incision. It worked, but the recovery was brutal and the scar was permanent. Then laparoscopy came along. Same goal, completely different approach, dramatically less collateral damage. TAAR1 agonists and D1 partial agonists are the laparoscopy of ADHD treatment. Same target, cleaner access.
That's going to be the image I carry around. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1783, a French expedition to the Caspian Basin recorded that local merchants converted 1 talent of silver into exactly 3,600 sheep. A unit ratio that would have baffled an accountant in Knossos, where linear B tablets show the same weight of silver buying roughly 120 sheep. The discrepancy exists because the Caspian merchants were counting live animals by head, while the Minoans were tallying wool output per animal over a 5-year shearing cycle. Same unit name, completely different commodity.
That's going to sit with me for a while.
Here's the question I keep coming back to. We've got two paths forward, new molecular targets like TAAR1 and D1, or clever formulations like a CNS-specific prodrug. Which one actually gets us there first?
The smart money is on the new target approach, and not just because it's further along in trials. The prodrug strategy is elegant, but it's solving a problem we might be able to sidestep entirely. If TAAR1 agonism gives you dopamine modulation without ever touching the transporter system, you don't need to figure out how to keep a DAT inhibitor out of the periphery, because there's no DAT inhibitor in the molecule at all.
The prodrug path is trying to make a safer version of the old mechanism. TAAR1 is a different mechanism entirely.
That's why the phase 3 readouts matter so much. If Ulotarant or a competitor can close that efficacy gap, get from 30% symptom reduction to something closer to 40 or 45, the case for sticking with transporter-based drugs gets a lot weaker.
There's a timeline problem. Even if those trials go perfectly, we're talking years before approval and years more before it's widely prescribed. In the meantime, millions of patients are still making that trade-off.
Which is why the near-term insights matter as much as the pipeline. Guanfacine augmentation, propranolol for anxiety, these aren't futuristic, they're available now. The question Daniel asked has a two-part answer. Long-term, the separation is possible and the proof of concept exists. Short-term, we manage the trade-off with smarter combinations of the tools we already have.
The bigger picture, the thing this whole conversation points toward, is that we're slowly learning how to target brain circuits without treating the whole body as collateral. That's not just an ADHD story. It's where all of psychopharmacology needs to go.
The brain is the only organ that routinely gets treated by bathing the entire bloodstream in a drug and hoping enough of it crosses over. That's the model we've been stuck with. What Daniel's asking about, can we be more precise? That's the question the whole field is trying to answer.
The answer, for now, is not yet, but we can see the shape of it from here.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop and to Daniel for the question that sent us down this rabbit hole.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us your own question, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.